Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremham.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. What originally started as a business conference for artists and fellow creatives is now being turned around to shine a light on our clients. From art buyers and creative teams to fellow producers and managers, this podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as the bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence, no matter what the medium. Today, we are clearing the docket. I've always wanted to say that as a fan of the podcast Judge John Husband, but we're not really clearing the docket, but we are doing a mega link roundup. We're taking a more in-depth look at some of the links that have been circulating just to kind of clear a bit of our backlog, but also to launch a new event series we're doing called Open Tabs. We'll talk a bit more about that. We'll look at everything from networking to the perils of the free economy and everything in between. But first, Lara, welcome home. How are you?
Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, I'm all right. Stupid Melbourne. No, I'm fine. It's good to be home, sort of.
We're very happy to see you. And Bianca, our Freaky Friday is now complete with you back in your natural place.
Yeah, I'm back in my natural habitat. The weirdo that I am is amongst the other weirdos in New York City.
It is a place to be weird. I noticed you updated your Slack avatar to an alien. And I was like, yep, I feel you.
How are you, Jeremy?
Well, I'm kind of wondering, were you using my Aesop body scrub while you were staying here?
Yes, I was.
Bastard. I knew it was this very empty when I was using it. This is the Aesop Resurrection body scrub. But it also
Aesop, Jeremy?
Whatever, Aesop. Anyway. But yeah, it's got
really
like rose.
Nice.
Yeah, but you smell like a lamb roast after it because it's got this rosemary in it. And I know it's kind of supposed to be all kind of natural.
Is that like a thing you're looking for?
No, I don't want to smell like a lamb roast, but I find that I do smell like a lamb roast now. Anyway, that's what it says to talk about how we're doing. That's how I'm doing. And just kind of letting you know.
That sounds weird. Like, what was I using? Yes, I was staying with you, Jeremy. I know I was staying at work.
You were staying at work and in the sleep bedroom, which we are hoping to start a new initiative called Sleep with Jackie Winter, where we are going to be offering our sleep room and a spare desk on Airbnb. I'm hoping to get that off in the next kind of 3 or 4 weeks.
Hot desking at Jackie Winter HQ.
Yeah, exactly. We just need to figure out how to lock up the liquor cabinet and everything else that we don't want people getting into.
I wish we had a liquor cabinet.
And the Aesop body scrub.
Yes. I've got my eye on you, Bramham. Okay, moving on. We're going to get stuck right into this, into our mega link roundup. Now, I think, yeah, links and talking about things that we found on the internet are just a really big part of, I guess, my personal practice of a creative and trying to kind of keep educated. And I often talk about my RSS feeds as a finely trimmed bonsai, just kind of many, many different little elements of just general interest that I kind of make sure I find the right sites and pick the right articles. And like, I've been doing this for like so long that I feel that it's in a really good place. And another thing that we really love doing as a business is doing events. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is an event that kind of took over from what we were doing before called Field Trip. And also I do Creative Mornings. I'm the host of the Melbourne chapter here. I've been doing that for around almost 6 years now. And yeah, love doing events. I love kind of getting out and meeting people and kind of interfacing with that in the real world. And yeah, we're starting a new event series, and we're doing this in collaboration with our friends at Sample Beer, and it's going to be called Open Tabs. And it's basically, it's kind of like talking about the internet and this idea of kind of trend forecasting as well, and just trying to put a finger on the pulse of kind of what's happening in the creative world by looking at people's open browser tabs. So it's kind of like a bastardized version of, I'm going to say this wrong, I don't even want to get into this with the whole pronunciation thing, but Pechacucha, which I hear is pronounced Pachacucha. Don't want to get into it. Don't at me. It's a bastardization between that and kind of Creative Morning. So we're launching it at M Pavilion in Melbourne. And it's going to be on Friday, the 20th of October at 6 p.m. And there's going to be Jackie Winter speakers and there's going to be some non-Jackie Winter speakers. So I think like 4 people, 10 tabs, 30 seconds a tab, just kind of going through it. And then we're going to be kind of rolling it out through our ad agency clients as well. So it's something that we're going to be kind of taking kind of in-house. So yeah, this is kind of a bit of a tie into that. So if you're at an agency and you want us to kind of do this event at your premises, drop us an email at podcast@jackiewinter.com. But otherwise, this also came about because there were simply so many good things happening in our professional development Slack. And yeah, I think we're just going to get just stuck right into this and just do a whole kind of episode on some of them. And hopefully, yeah, you'll find something that interests you. So look, this was an, I'm going to start with this one, which is blagging, dark art or essential creative skill. And this came out through the It's Nice That blog, which is, you know, one of my, you know, favorite, I guess, online publications that kind of, it's very London and English kind of focus, but really has a focus on illustration design in a specific kind of aesthetic. And I clicked this link because I didn't know what blagging was. And I don't know if I am any, it's like, I feel like this is a term that is somewhat like ubiquitous, but Laura, what did you get from
this?
They
make it, so I had never heard the term blagging before this article.
And then how do they define it?
Dictionaried it. Well, it's they defined it as like sort of using rhetoric to sort of persuade people of something, to convince people of something, but like it's not necessarily true. But I was looking at all these different definitions of it, and everything was kind of none of them really matched. So I don't know if it's really like an all-pervasive word just yet. The author of the article is Naresh Ramchandani, one of the partners at Pentagram. And I guess, like, I don't know, it was interesting. She clearly doesn't feel good about blagging.
It just seems to me, it's like, it's one of these things where, I don't know, like, you know, they, maybe it's a word that they use at the studio and now it's just kind of, it's like they are foisting it upon us. Like it's supposed to be normal and something that we actually kind of do. I've never heard of it. It's just kind of
make fetch happen.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Dave.
Exactly. But you do see that, like, I think in a lot of these articles where, you know, and this is kind of how new terminology and new ideas kind of get into the mainstream because people just put it out there. Like, this is kind of a thing. I don't think blagging is a thing. It's just basically how you convince people of something in a creative pitch. I don't know if
but
it needs
its own term. But the examples they were using are like when you haven't actually done a great job on the work or you are sort of like running really behind, the creative isn't that strong, and you just sort of have a lot of showmanship sort of to convince people that it is actually good rather than owning up to it.
It's called turd polishing. I think that's the best way to put it. That's all we need.
But as well, she goes on about how, like, you know, the great work should sell itself. And I mean, I don't know. For me, like, I think the key thing to point out here is the difference between what she calls blagging and, like, general showmanship skills. Because, yeah, of course, there's an issue when the confidence in your idea or actions is made up. You know, when you are relying on rhetoric rather than, you know, the quality of what you've actually done. But I think being able to present and sell in your work is still a pretty essential skill as long as it's based on fact.
Definitely. And I do think people need those skills, especially kind of designers. And we talked about creative people that they shouldn't just rely on other people being able to sell it. But yeah, look, but that's an interesting one. And by the way, all of these links will be in our show notes that we do publish every week. It's in the podcast descriptions, but also you can sign up to our podcast specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter. So next up was an app. And this is something that I was looking at a lot because after one of our links last week, which was all about the kind of 10 steps of how to really kind of physically disconnect from your phone, this kind of popped up in another Slack, actually. I don't know how old this app is. And it kind of is developed by Marco Arment, who is a very divisive figure in the tech and kind of social media world. He's one of the founders of Tumblr, but also he's a programmer, writer, podcaster, geek, and coffee enthusiast. He's developed the podcast app that I personally use, which is called Overcast. And he's got this app called Quitter, which is a Mac app. And it's based on an article that he wrote about automatic social discipline. And this is, yeah, just something that I thought kind of tied in. Bianca, what did you think, kind of think about this as someone who, you know, is a big fan of kind of, you know, getting offline, shutting down Slack for a bit, all those
kind
of things?
Can you tell us first, what does Quitter do?
Quitter is an app that you install on your operating system that automatically hides or quits apps after periods of inactivity. I think what they're trying to do is combat, like if you use things like, you know, you might need to use social media for work, but if it's kind of sitting there idle, you might dip back in for personal use, and that, you know, that can kind of maybe sway your focus a little bit. So this automatically quits apps that have been inactive for a while, and so it helps minimize distraction. I think that's the intention. I don't know. I like to disengage, but I don't really understand
I don't get this either. I just think it just means I'd have to keep reopening stuff when I need it, and that sounds like it would waste more time.
Yeah, I mean, Jeremy, like, would you use this?
No. I liked it because it was interesting, and I liked the kind of idea of different apps that are kind of that kind of monitor your time and kind of where you are and kind of can quantify that a bit more. Like, I spent all of last weekend, or a lot of last weekend, like looking at kind of dumb phones. So there's this phone called the Punked M1 or something, which is basically a beautifully designed phone, but that only does kind of phone calls, you know? But it's funny because a lot of these phones like don't run on like they all run on the 2G network, which doesn't exist in Australia anymore. But yeah, like I'm interested in kind of how I'm interested in different things that help,
like, you know, focus your attention.
Break. Yeah, exactly. But it is kind of ironic in some ways, because I did turn off all of my notifications, for example, like ages ago when I went on a holiday, I never turned them back on. But now I find that I actually check my phone more because I'm not getting notifications.
Yeah, you don't want to miss out on any of them.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's an interesting idea, but as something that I would actually use, I wouldn't. But I do, I mean, we obviously work in a very highly administrative role where our kind of default state is multitasking. And I think this is like multitasking and just like distractions, especially from social media and things like that, is what this is actually trying to combat.
Well, look, it really is based on an article that came out in 2015 as well, like that where the initial idea came from. So it's almost 2 years after that fact now. And yeah, like I think if anything, it's interesting to kind of see this is something that's kind of coming up in conversation. And this is just one way to address it.
Yeah, so. I mean, I was just going to say that, like, I mean, we don't have the luxury at Jackie Winter being producers to have really too many moments of deep focus. And, you know, I think Lara and I, we were talking about it the other day, like we constantly kind of jump back and forth between tasks and between projects, and it can be hard to keep focus. So I actually use a little simple Pomodoro counter app called Tomato One, which kind of, like, you know, I might run it for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, just to kind of like keep me focused on the task at hand, because it can be really easy, you know, if I'm like sending an invoice to halfway through that, you know, I might see that I've got a notification for an email, and I might check that. And yeah, I'm just trying to like channel my focus and energy into like the one task.
Next up, we have some research from the team at signs.com. This is called Branded in Memory, 10 Iconic Logos, 156 Americans, 80 Hours of Drawing from Memory. So basically here, the team at signs.com asked over 150 Americans to draw 10 famous logos from memory as accurately as they could. And they wanted to see whether the logos of these global corporations like Apple, Starbucks, Foot Locker had actually created the strong mental brand associations that they strive for. And it's pretty interesting, Bea, I think you picked this one up. What did you like about this?
Yeah, my friend sent it to me. It's really interesting. I mean, like, how accurately can we recall logos that we see on a daily basis? And there's things like Apple, Starbucks, Domino's, IKEA. I actually got Arta, who works alongside me here in the New York office, to try and draw the Starbucks logo from memory. And she did a pretty good job. But it was funny because the research, it kind of broke down that of people who drew the Starbucks mermaid, 45% forgot that she wears a crown. And that was the exact thing that Arta forgot to draw.
It's also interesting that, I mean, this project was actually done much earlier by a Melbourne-based designer called Stephen Banham, who must be burning up that his initial idea that was actually turned into a book, didn't get as much traction as this got recently. And it makes me wonder as well, like, how many kind of amazing design projects, you know, that were done, you know, before, I guess, you know, the huge rise of the internet are kind of laying dormant, that we're kind of exploring similar ideas. But we'll link to both Stephen's project and the more recent one as well.
We should try and do some and pop them in the show notes, see how well we can remember them.
That's a great idea. Maybe do our own logo from memory.
Oh, shit. I don't actually think I could do it.
There is a crown. Problem. There is a crown.
There's definitely a crown, yeah.
Lara, you know, as our resident AI specialist.
That's me.
Tell us what you found here about the first ad course via Facebook bot.
So I didn't find this one, but it's interesting. It's, a few Sydney creatives launched an online advertising course that runs over Messenger. And I love Messenger bots. There are a couple that I use, like, every day, and I'm pretty excited to see it being used in new and different ways. So this is called Bot Ad School, or BAS for short. The idea is that it sort of leads students through 7 tailored chapters based on their skill set and geographical location. And it's designed to be a stepping stone into the ad industry, making it more accessible to young creatives. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how useful it'll be, but I think it's interesting. And I like seeing people use this technology in this kind of way for this kind of purpose.
We found this on Campaign Brief, and maybe like as part of the bot, like it will just kind of spit out really nasty comments about your creative, no matter what you send it. Yeah, just to get you used to it. Sorry, B, what were you going to say?
I'm still not used to it.
Well, I was so dubious. I mean, I've actually never engaged with a messenger bot before, and I was kind of dubious.
Because you don't use Facebook.
Sorry, Bianca, I have something to tell you.
No, I was dubious about like a tool like Messenger actually being an appropriate platform for learning, but I gave it a spin and I actually enjoyed it. Like, I mean, we speak so often. I mean, we just spoke, you know, 2 minutes ago about distraction, and it's kind of unfortunate, but like getting fed like really small bite-sized pieces of information in an interactive way was possibly the most engaged I've been in quite a long time.
Look, machine learning is really coming to a head at the moment in so many different ways. Google last night just had their big keynote where they launched a whole new suite of products. And it's
the earbuds.
Oh my God, the earbuds are insane, which translate automatically for
in
you.
Real time. So two people can speak in totally different languages. And you can,
not in real time.
It's not real time.
Sorry, I just watched the demo. But yeah, I mean, everything about this whole thing was about machine learning. And yeah, I think you're not alone in feeling that kind of engagement. It's definitely something that's about to reach a fever pitch. So yeah, seeing how different people are using the creative industry is definitely something to keep an eye on.
So our next link is another, surprise, surprise, Fast Company link, our favorite website.
Look, give us credit for only including one.
Only including, yeah, that's actually pretty good. So this is about how to make Slack less of a time suck, which
Time suck
is our new band, we've decided. I mean, we talk a lot about how to use Slack effectively and whether or not it helps or hinders productivity. So this came from an employee at a company called Help Scout. And they've basically devised a set of strategies for managing Slack to hopefully ensure that it helps productivity. Jeremy, what'd you get from this?
Well, yeah, I the reason I like this is because there were actually some decent solutions in here.
I learned some things.
I never realized you could start things.
No, see, that was like the number one that I learned from this article.
Yeah.
Well, look, yeah, I mean, that is one of the interesting things with Slack is that one they write amazingly hilarious update, like software update notes.
Oh, I love the software really good. Update notes.
But actually in the app itself, there's like a little gift box and that kind of takes you through some of the updates and they're moving kind of really, really quick. But yeah, things like highlight words I thought are kind of really good in kind of when and controlling notifications, because I do find that, I mean, I have a visceral physical reaction to notifications. I remember in an earlier build of Slack, there was a bug which just caused there to be the blue dot on one of my Slack teams saying that there was an unread thing when there wasn't. And it was killing me. And I was like, I just want the dot to go away. I got like physically tense from it. So
you can just double click.
Sorry?
You can just double click.
Anyway, there was the whole idea of kind of being able to kind of highlight certain words to get notifications. So like, you know, this idea that you just turn off your notifications and then you turn them back on selectively as you kind of need them. Setting away hours and just kind of, you know, and notifications and talking to yourself. So we used to have to kind of set calendar reminders or send emails to ourselves and everything. And just being able to kind of talk to yourself using
reminders were an absolute game changer for me. Like, I really embrace them and I'm always trying to get everyone else to, because I use them all day, every day. And it's such an awesome way to like prune down your to-do list to the things that actually only need to be
right
on there.
And yeah. I think that's an interesting way to look at this, where kind of where using Slack more effectively might not be about using Slack less, but using Slack to do kind of things that you might take longer to do in other things.
Exactly. So, the thing I liked so much about this article though was just like the very start when they use the sort of metaphor of like communicating in Slack can begin to feel like drinking from a fire hose. And to me, like that mental image of like trying to take a sip while the water's like blasting everywhere is such a good way to describe how, you know, full-blown office Slack
can
feel.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting for me being back in Melbourne, because we obviously have a bigger team in Melbourne. So there's far more updates happening throughout the day on Slack, because there's just like, you know, like a lot more people contributing to the Slack channel. And that was overwhelming.
Yeah, that was one of the big things I missed when you were in here. Like, one of my favorite things is waking up and getting all my Slacks from Bianca.
Well, what I friggin' hated while I was in the US was I would like, during the day, I would like post stuff on Slack, either stuff that I actually needed to know an answer to, like genuinely needed to ask the team, or I would make a great call, some hilarious joke, and no one would respond during your workday, and it was so frustrating.
Yeah, see, like, Namsan was one of the funniest things I've ever seen. But like,
you gave me nothing.
I know, you missed the window. Okay, we got to move on. We got to move on. We got to link to Namsan, though. Next up, good news for young strivers. Networking is overrated. Look, I kind of, this again, I mean, a bit of a clickbaity headline.
From
just
the
like
New York
the
Times.
Blagging. From the New York Times. But I mean, I think networking is not overrated. I think networking is still kind of essential. Maybe the kind of word networking is, but
I think networking for networking's sake is overrated.
Yes, that's the point there. The networking without any skills or great work behind it is pointless.
Well, that yeah, and I think
but that's obvious. I mean, to me, no?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it gets into this whole kind of, I mean, personal brand thing, I think, as well, which is, I mean, a bit problematic.
Well, the thing they sort of say is that, like, you know, there's the argument versus, like, networking helps you accomplish great things versus, you know, accomplishing great things helps you develop a network.
Right.
You know, and which should come first, and how sort of, like, lots of students often believe that, like, they need to just meet more and more and more important people and just, like, keep connecting with like key figures, blah, 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 and their work will sort of magically improve. And people keep getting sort of told that over and over again. But yeah, they sort of said that like it's sort of hard to actually engage with those people in any sort of useful level unless you've already sort of put something valuable out into the world. And you know, that in the end is what's going to pique the curiosity of these people. And achievements show that you have something to give, not just something to take.
Yeah. No, interesting.
Next link we've got here from Design Sponge. I don't know, my brain. Jeremy, I just got off 24 hours of flying.
No,
give me a break.
No excuse to not know what a sponge is.
Do artists and designers have an obligation to be political? So,
yes.
There
we go, next.
No, I mean, the author's answer was certainly yes.
Yeah.
And their yes sort of comes down to simply, I guess, to, you know, deconstructing privilege and a moral duty to help those in lesser positions than ourselves. I think I liked there was a line that said, everything that we as culture producers create is cultural data that others consume. Regardless of a maker's intentions, art is political once it's available to any audience. Even something as seemingly neutral as a chair has political implications. And then they have this great little illustration of like the Eames chair showing like, okay, well, what sort of materials does it use? Is the factory, you know, fair trade? Is it who can afford it? Blah, blah, blah. And how, yeah, even a chair can be deeply political.
Look, I think of all the topics that we've posted here, this is probably one that we need to spin a whole episode into because it is so important. I think especially now with everything that's kind of happening, you know, in politics. And I think that, yeah, it's something that I haven't really, I'm surprised hasn't kind of risen more to kind of the forefront of discussion in the design community. I know there are definitely many outspoken designers, but when I was in art school, there was the magazine Adbusters, and they put out their First Things First manifesto, which really took a kind of strong stand in terms of how we're supposed to, I guess, navigate these kind of questions. And yeah, I don't want to get too stuck into it now because I do think it's a really rich conversation that I want to kind of come back to.
Yeah.
But I think it's something I think many people who work in design can sometimes feel a bit impotent in that way, like where, like, you know, they are doing things that are kind of superficial. But yeah, one of my favorite design examples that I talk about, it's like one of the first things I talk about anytime I do a lecture, is when Edward Tufte kind of gives his example about the heat sinks in the Challenger disaster and how the way people interpreted that, you know, might have been responsible for the fact that things were done incorrectly and the spaceship exploded. So the fact that, yeah, like you say, all design can be political and is inherently political in many ways, but also every design act, no matter how minor, can have, you know, huge impact in the real world. So
totally. I mean, the thing with this article, though, the thing that kind of annoyed me was that, like, yes, you know, she goes on to outline these like really important rules for how to make political statements without being appropriative, and she says speaking up without speaking over, which I really like, and they're all really great and really valid, and I definitely agree with the overall argument that yes, you know, you should be sort of political with your work, and you are whether you want to or not. But what frustrated me about the article and the discussion I would like to see go further is, you know, it doesn't really look at, you know, the challenges of putting that into practice in a commercial world, and, you know, it would be interesting to read about the obstacles that brings, and for someone to look critically at both sides of that argument, because I think she clearly here makes the sort of morally correct argument, but it's very black and white, and that's all well and good, but when put into practice IRL, that might actually be really difficult. And I think for me, that's the interesting angle, is how do you balance being politically minded and being moral in a commercial world where you don't necessarily get to make that decision.
I think this comes down to also designers expanding their skill sets and really looking. I mean, this is where I guess blagging, you know, might actually come into effect, and actually designers knowing and educating themselves more about strategy in terms of how to sell design and really making sure that design is fulfilling a purpose in that regard, and how to talk about your design and kind of sell it, because that's how you can maybe enact some of those changes.
Can we not start using the word blagging?
I'm so sorry. See, it happened. It's happening.
Next up, what have we got, Jeremy?
Well, maybe you should introduce this one as not only our resident AI specialist, but as our resident grammar nerd.
Yeah, look, okay. So this is a new tool, Typely, online proofreading. And look, we've talked about things like this before. In general, I don't like these sorts of tools. I think that they stop people from actually learning the rules properly. And I think that language and construction of language is such a complex art and one that requires a much deeper understanding in order to be able to brandish it well. And I think that tools like this tend to generally oversimplify things to the point where people don't understand why the mistakes they're making are mistakes. And, you know, to me, that's vital because the tools are never completely correct. Every time I've used one, they're just like a bit off. And so to just accept them blindly.
The one that everyone knows is Grammarly, which I agree is.
Yeah. But that said, I acknowledge that, not everyone wants or requires a deep understanding of syntax. And so like a tool like this can be really helpful for general writing.
This tool though? How does it differ from
They don't look at grammar, right? Basically, unlike Grammarly. They look at usage. But even including, it sort of says that it looks at things like sexism in language and stuff like that, which
hedging, again, apologizing, I don't know how, pretension.
Yeah. But again, like unless you actually know the tone of what the piece is and the purpose, I just don't think that a tool like this is, I don't know, it didn't work for me and I don't love it. And I think maybe if you just do like not a lot of writing and stuff, then it's great to have something like this. But I think if you are actually, they talk about how this is a tool for writers and editors and proofreaders. And if you are actually a writer, editor, or communicator of any sort by trade, then it's not safe to rely on tools like this to perfect your work. Like you should understand these things on your own.
Look, and I think a lot of these things, I mean, this could go back to the kind of Quitter app that we were talking about as well. It's like sometimes it's really just about generating enough interest and self-awareness to kind of realize this is something that you might want to educate yourself in more.
Yes,
I'm sure this
that
is
I agree with.
Not the intention of the actual developers who probably need to make a business out of it. But I think one of the more kind of positive long-term effects is that, those deeper skills will kind of start to emerge. And
it can be a good prompt for you to learn more about these things further, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, and that's what I like also. I mean, we're going to talk about two smaller tools after this. There's one I need to find. I don't have the link to it offhand, but it's one that keeps your email. Like I think it's a Gmail plugin that doesn't let your emails go for longer than 125 words, and it's supposed to just kind of make just try to force you.
Be able to send an email, Jeremy.
This is why I don't do Twitter. And even with the 240 characters, I think I could never do it. Yeah, my emails are infamously long.
Wait, it's 240 now?
Oh, yeah. Lots of things happened while you were in America.
Oh, my God. I'm so out of the loop.
Also,
anyway,
I am president of Australia.
I thought so. Prime Minister.
The next two links are kind of more about tab management. I mean, there's a whole series of apps that obviously are kind of standalone, but there's a whole bunch of kind of browser extensions as well that I think more specifically work with Chrome. And that's kind of why we used to work with Safari because it was really
a bit more robust.
Yeah. Well, you know,
Safari.
Look, one of the big problems with browsers, especially with us, is ironically our open tabs because they run.
Keeping open at any one time? Like the fact that we're talking about tab management is really bizarre to me because
I have like 20 to 40 tabs open at any given time.
Yeah, I have so many tabs open that I don't even get the favicons anymore because they're so stacked up next to each other.
I do when I'm using my external screen, and then as soon as I use my actual laptop, it's just like all a sea of gray.
But since everything runs in the browser, we're running kind of all of our Google Docs in kind of, you know, and you have separate windows now, not only kind of separate tabs. Anyway, the reason this comes up is for two plugins that have been doing the rounds here in the office. One of them, which I swear by, is called the Great Suspender. I just love this because literally what it does is it shuts down a tab, but keeps it kind of in, you can just reload it to kind of bring it back up. So if you have 100 open tabs.
So it unloads the tab.
It unloads the tab.
But it retains the favicon and the title text.
Exactly.
Stuff. Yes.
And it just just, it makes the whole, it has been the number one thing that has sped up my computing experience, like bar none. And then,
yeah, the whole idea is to like reduce the memory usage. Yeah,
exactly. And Chrome and so many websites can be huge memory sucks in that way. So if you are having computer performance
issues, I'm installing it right now.
Yeah, it is so good. And then what is Tabagotchi, which is something that was going around some of the more manga inspired members of our team.
Oh, it's a Chrome extension as well, which is actually I think it's actually an advertisement for a it was put out by Breather, which is actually a service that you can use here in New York where you can rent a desk or you can rent like a quiet meeting room. So Tabagotchi is like a Chrome extension that it's like a Tamagotchi, and the more tabs that you have open, the less healthy your Tamagotchi is.
Yeah, but like, just let me live. I like having lots of tabs open. This is why I like the suspender one, because it's like it leaves them open, but it helps me have.
Why do you want to kill the Tabagotchi?
I just like, I'm quite surprised that we're actually talking about this, because like I maybe have like four tabs open at the one time, and that's what I'm working on.
Yeah, Bianca, you're a minimalist, and you have like four things in your apartment, so.
Yeah, Bianca, the biggest thing that we spoke about, like, when you were here is how Bianca's actually, wants to buy a piece of furniture and, like, how this is a big thing for you. I don't know if that's too intimate to reveal on the podcast.
You know, I think I've just...
You got rid of my chair at my desk. Like, you started getting rid of my items.
Thank you,
by the way. I've kind of become comfortable with the fact that, you know, like, the internet is this big black hole of information, and it's not the end of the world if, like, I open something and I don't consume it. Like, I'm totally happy. Like, if I haven't read something, it's probably not worth reading. So I just kind of like leave it. Actually, no, I do want to give you guys something that you might actually like. I was talking in the office with the girls here in New York about this, and Kara did alert me to a tool called OneTab, which she uses quite a bit when she's doing research for editorial stuff. But OneTab actually aggregates all of the tabs that you have open and puts it into, I guess, like almost like a list. So if you do have 100 tabs open and you want to kind of like collect them all into the one place and refer back to them, OneTab might be good for that.
Yeah, I used OneTab for like, I don't know, 6 months or something. And then I found that if something went into my OneTab, it went into the bin. Like, it meant, yeah, I was never going to read it.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas if I just leave them open, then I do eventually get through them, or I look at it, reassess, and close it and accept that I'm not going to read it. But it was like having, you know, like a big chest of drawers in your room that you can keep shoving things into and not have to decide whether you throw them out.
And also, yeah, one tab did crash on me once. I lost about like 300 open tabs. I declared internet bankruptcy by accident. Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Next up, how to work with arseholes, a survivor's guide. We need this. I mean, we don't really, actually. We work with really lovely people.
Well, look, I you know, this is just something that like was like an automatic buy as soon as I kind of saw the book. Because, this kind of came up a bit when we were kind of trying to, again, a previous link from the Oprah thing that we were talking about, where it's like, you know, trying to have more empathy for people and trying to understand where people are coming from. But like, you know, I am not going to lie. We have worked with some assholes before.
Everyone does.
Everyone does. It's part of the job. But like, you know, addressing it is really just important. I mean, look, this book, did you get that it was more for working with assholes like as clients or working with assholes inside an office?
Yeah, so this is Robert Sutton is a professor of management science and engineering at Stanford. And so his book is How to Work with Arseholes. And I think the original motivation was actually, what does it take to build a truly civilized workplace? So that was the motivation behind the book. But I guess in that it's really about like, yeah, how do you deal with arseholes?
Yeah. Well, he gives us like three key takeaways in this interview. And I'm like, do I need to buy the book? But I was interesting. Like,
what were the key takeaways?
It's common sense, but like it's true. I mean, the first one he said, like, his main piece of advice is keep your distance. Like, actually, like, if these people drive you crazy and spark sort of negative energy and whatever, then just stay away from them as much as you can. Number two is to give yourself time before replying to anything, whether that's actually,
like
in person, like taking a moment to think before you speak, or if it's like an email and, you know, taking the night to sleep on it and things like that. And then also, the third was to make sure that you're checking yourself to see if there's anything you're doing that's provoking the behavior in any way.
That was the biggest one for me, to actually look inside yourself and,
Anyway, that's from 99U, which is, I haven't seen many updates from them recently. It's part of Behance, but it's an amazing, amazing site with some great articles there. Next up, we have an announcement from one of my favorite designers, writers, and people, Coy Vinh. I met him when he was the design director of the New York Times Online, and he runs a very famous design blog called Subtraction. And it was amazing to see this product launch, because when I met Coy, like maybe around 7 or 8 years ago, he had a prototype that he kind of sent me that he actually... he worked with one of our artists, Oslo Davis, on kind of doing it. And I still have it in a drawer somewhere. And now he has kind of officially launched it with a company called Baron Fig, who's kind of a stationery company. And he's expanded the idea a bit more for the project, which is kind of a bit more kind of photo based, which is different to the illustrated version that I saw.
And what is it?
The whole idea is it's a sketchbook that has kind of elements there that are kind of unfinished, basically. Like, so you have kind of a horse without a head, or a lighthouse stripes, or a person kind of looking like they're just kind of sitting on something. And the idea is that you kind of use that to kind of then sketch on top of, basically. But then it's all in kind of this non-repro blue ink, so you can kind of photocopy it, and then the actual kind of the images kind of drop out from there when you decide to scan.
I bought like kind of a similar thing, but it's funny. I guess just thinking about like how different people think. I bought a book when I was in New York. I went to the Sketchbook Library in Brooklyn, which is just like, oh my God, I could have spent days there. They have 36,000 sketchbooks from artists all over the world. They also sold these books where basically they give you like verbal prompts to help to sketch stuff. But the prompts will be like really random. It'll be like, I don't know, a trip to the Jewish bakery will be like the prompt. And then you just like draw whatever comes to your mind when you do that. And they had this whole book, and each page had all these different random props. So it's kind of a similar thing, but just verbal rather than visual.
Well, I thought it was kind of like talking about blagging. I thought that the headline though for this article, it was like, this is the funnest sketchbook you'll ever use. And I'm not actually sure that it is the funnest sketchbook that I'll ever use. One thing I did, I was on the Baron Fig website though, and I kind of like got into like a little bit of a click hole, and I did discover that they have what looks like a very interesting podcast. And the latest episode is with Coy Vinh, who you just mentioned. And I'm really excited to, I think this is going to be my new How I Built This.
Oof, that's a big call. Speaking of new podcasts, Basecamp has a new podcast out called Rework, which is in its fourth episode, which is really good.
I haven't listened yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds good at 2X. I listen to all my podcasts. And finally, our last link of the day. We made it. We didn't really make it. We had to cut like 10 links because there were so many. But I think what we'll end on is a piece from Inc.com about the business consulting industry is booming and how it's about to be disrupted. Since our last episode where we talked about consulting companies kind of consolidating and buying agencies and doing stuff, there was a huge movement here where... Oh, God, now I got to remember.
Deloitte just brought in, instead of buying an agency, they brought in a lot of talent from McCann.
And like, you know, McCann Melbourne being one of the most awarded agencies internationally, especially after the Dumb Ways to Die campaign. So, yeah, three, like, you know, it's interesting how they're approaching it. So, yeah, some people are buying companies. Some people are making their own kind of, divisions within there. And this was kind of, a talent kind of hire. But, yeah, this article is really saying that this activity or like these consulting industries are about to be disrupted by something else. What is that?
Well, I mean, they say that essentially the argument they're making is that an industry becomes susceptible to disruption when it becomes so entrenched in its sort of like very long-standing solutions of financial structure and doesn't sort of change or shift like that. And, you know, there are often disruptive innovations that can provide simpler or more elegant solutions to existing problems, which tend to be enabled by sort of new technologies and at lower costs. And, you know, they sort of start out with very basic examples of, you know, thinking like calculators versus computers, Amazon versus bookstores, Netflix versus Blockbuster, etc. And, you know, yes, management consulting is this huge behemoth that is booming at the moment, but it's not immune to the dynamics of disruption. So the article looks at five qualities that are like inherent to the management consulting industry that make it susceptible to technology-driven disruption. And they also look at how, you know, whilst many consultants and consulting firms have established practices of, you know, advising clients on strategies to like leverage these disruptive trends and technologies, very few actually apply this to themselves, and how, you know, investing in the technological innovations and next generation business models is a fundamentally paradoxical concept in an industry that is so driven by billable hours, billable days, and sort of closely held best practices that come in this form of, you know, knowledge capital.
Yeah, look, I think it's an interesting point just to end on, considering, I think when anything gets too big, things can get really kind of messy, and that's kind of where things usually do kind of topple over. And nothing does kind of, you think about things like, you know, before our time, like I was just talking to someone yesterday about how Kodak was just like such a big business, and nobody thought that that was going to go anywhere. And that's one business that was very disrupted by technology in that way. And I think, you know, when we're talking about kind of AI, machine learning, and all those things that are really going to impact the creative industry, it's why it's important to kind of know these things, you know, whether you're a client, whether you're a creative, because it's going to have very big impacts in a lot of a more compressed timeline than I think we've seen in the past. So look, I hope you've enjoyed this little dig through our brains for this last little while.
I can close a lot of my tabs now. It's very satisfying.
Your Tamagotchi.
I can't close them until next week because I got to actually link to them when we put our show notes together.
You chose this live, Jeremy.
Tab live.
I did choose it. If you want to get all of these links, again, please sign up to our newsletter specific for the podcast. It's just a text-only thing. We send it every Friday. You'll get all the links that we talk about. You'll get a link to the latest episode of the podcast. You can sign up at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter. But before we leave, we're just going to go over the most Melbourne and most New York thing that's happened to us this week.
I've just had a lot of I love New York moments since I've only been back here a couple of days, but oh God, I just walked out before we recorded this episode, and it was golden hour in the Empire State. No, sorry, the Chrysler Building just looked beautiful, and I just had a little tear in my eye. I'm happy to be home. Actually, no, I was at a bar the other night waiting for my friend, and it was Thursday, and it was about 8 o'clock at night. And this is kind of like the most weirdly like Bushwick American thing that maybe happened, but these kids that were sitting at the bar were doing shots off hot dogs, like that you'd hold the hot dog towards your mouth and the bartender like poured, I don't know whether it was like tequila or vodka, like you like down the hot, like using the hot dog as a vessel for the shot. That was bizarre.
Way to ruin a perfectly good hot dog.
Laura, what's the most Melbourne thing?
I have a New York thing because I literally just got home.
Okay, fair enough. I'll bend the rules.
Thanks, mate.
No worries.
My last night in New York, I was just with a friend. I had a, you know, during the day picnic in Central Park. Thought it'd do a very cliche New York thing, and it was beautiful. And then we were walking home and we heard music and we thought, oh, we'll go just see what that music is. And we like, I couldn't really figure it out. And then we saw these people like dressed in red and white. And I thought, okay. And then there were all these signs that said like Polish Heritage Day. And we're like, oh, okay, there's some sort of festival going on in Central Park. And we stumbled in and they were sort of introducing someone to come on stage and we weren't really paying that much attention. And then Shaggy came on stage as the headline act for Polish Heritage Day. And it was just like tons of Polish nanas dancing to Shaggy. It was awesome. And then there was this like random dude in the park selling margaritas out of one of those like nana trolleys. Like he was shaking them in a Tupperware and we bought them because that seems like a good life decision. Anyway, it was all very New York. That would never happen in like, you know, the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne.
That's amazing. There's no way I can top any of those things, so I won't even try. Thank you very much, Bianca.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and Shaggy and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Arij Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff at soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. You can go to our Facebook page and see photos from our 10-year anniversary as well, where Jackie Winter played. Clara from Jackie Winter actually went to see Jackie Winter play the other night because we got some new fans. He's really good.
He's really good.
You've got to see him. Check out his stuff. If you like what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. And speaking of tabs, I've had our podcast in iTunes loaded in a tab. I've been refreshing it kind of every day, thinking like, where are the, like, all the reviews coming in? Like, there's only three here. And then I looked at it in actual iTunes, and there's like 31 reviews, which is amazing.
Because I've been doing the same thing, and there's
only
three.
I know, exactly. So, but yeah.
Where's my phone?
Actually, it just shows you those three reviews, but you have to go into like actually the Apple Music app to see all the reviews. So if you want to see them and be inspired to write your own review, please do so. Because yeah, reviews are what get people kind of listening to this, and we want more people to listen because then we know kind of what to talk about. And
because then our parents will love us.
Yes, because there are some things that houseplants cannot fill the void in our hearts for, and that is your comments on our podcast. You can get more details on our website at jackiewinter.gives.you.the.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye.